Chapter 3, The Attack of the Moles. Gwen DeMarco. They are so cute. Guy Fliegman. Sure, they're cute now, but in a second they're going to get mean, and they're going to get ugly somehow, and there's going to be a million more of them. From the movie Galaxy Quest, DreamWorks, 1999. All answering services perform the same function for their clients, and my newly purchased answering service was no exception. At all hours of the day and night, our TSRs took incoming calls from our clients' callers. When clients called in, the TSRs read the written messages back to them. It was the mid-1980s when, for much of the business world, word processing and computer database management were little more than future concepts. We were a mom-and-pop service, and for a flat rate of $35 to $45 per month, we processed as many calls as the client could send us. During the day, two TSRs handled calls. After hours, one. From the beginning and for 15 subsequent years, I managed all aspects of the operation myself. From the first day of ownership, it was a madhouse because most of our clients had taken advantage of the flat rate arrangement and used our TSRs as their full-time telephone receptionists. Our staff were overwhelmed with call traffic, and so the quality of call handling was abysmal. At first, because I had no understanding of the internal mechanics of the answering service business, all I could do was watch and wonder. When I bought the business, the monthly total gross revenue of $5,500 was not enough to cover wages, rent, telephone company costs, and everything else, including supporting myself and my two children. The business had been mine for only 2 months, and disaster was already at hand. Disaster at hand was to become a serial catchphrase over the ensuing years. Standing by without taking action would be a quick ticket to failure. So, with my staff and my 8 and 10-year-olds depending on me, I had to do something immediately. Here, my brashness would be useful. It was a fortunate irony that the business was in terrible shape when I bought it. Some positive aspects lay hidden. After just a few weeks, the major problems were obvious, even to me, someone with zero knowledge of the industry. It was clear I must immediately correct the most glaring inefficiency. A customer pricing schedule that was too low. The fortunate part was that our service rates were extremely low. We could raise them significantly and still remain competitive. I informed our clients by letter that service rates were going up and we would start charging for the actual call traffic we handled for their individual accounts. I told them a large price hike was the only choice if we were to stay in business. So we dropped the flat rate billing plan and began counting message slips, billing each account for actual messages processed by the TSRs. On average, this tripled our customers' costs, and immediately one-third of them terminated service, while others cut down the call traffic forwarded to us. The decrease in incoming call traffic allowed our TSRs to spend more time on each call, and because they were less rushed, the quality of service improved, the first of many incremental quality improvements that were to accumulate over the years ahead. As a sidelight, and to illustrate just how low our service rates had been, even with a 300% increase, our prices remained lower than our much larger local answering service competitor. Despite losing more than 30% of our total client base, monthly revenues doubled overnight to $11,000. The huge increase in income was terrific, but equipment had to be upgraded and wages raised. So even with the additional cash boost, the company was still not profitable. We raised rates again in 6 months, and then again 6 months after that. 1 year later, we did it again. Nonetheless, we continued to struggle. This just barely hanging on predicament endured. Over the next decade and a half, we couldn't get ahead, even though we managed to multiply gross receipts by a factor of 12. Our revenue growth was due to rate increases, a booming economy, and the new clients we gained because of our growing reputation for quality. Quality that had risen from terrible to marginal. But marginal quality was better than our local competitor who remained at the terrible level because of their own self-perpetuated chaos. The rise in income was always matched by increases in operating costs. The largest increases were in wages, health insurance, retirement, and other benefits to the TSR staff. Within 3 years, we moved to a larger office space. We stayed in that location for 12 years and then moved into an even larger space. We continued to grow, but the turmoil and cash flow problems increased. For a decade and a half, my small salary didn't change while my 80 to 100-hour work weeks continued unabated. I had no life outside the business, and any personal time went to my children. As the years passed, I learned the ropes and prided myself on being expert at every facet of the business, able to perform any function. Within moments, I could move from scheduling staff to handling customer complaints to solving telephone company problems. I could interview a job applicant for a TSR position 1 minute, and in the next, put together a plan for adding a computer system. I could prepare payroll while I signed up a new account, and then head to the bank to plead my case for yet another small loan. I did it all, including being there as the single parent of my kids. The task juggling at home rivaled the task juggling at the office. What a feeling of power as I simultaneously solved multiple problems. I was a master of survival juggling, a fire killer extraordinaire. How heroic! But in my arrogance, and swept up in the endless fire killing, I was spinning my wheels and headed for destruction. This survival thing is killing me. With the exception of whatever happened to be going on in my mind on any given day, there was no direction for the company. Centrotel grew because of a booming local economy and my knack for foiling the reaper at the last minute. Through those years, I single-handedly fixed whatever needed to be fixed, smoothed out the rough spots, and kept the ball rolling no matter the day of the week or the time of the day. Long-term planning didn't happen, and routine maintenance was no more than a vague concept for the future. The numbers are gloomy. Statistics show that of 100 new business startups, only 20 will remain after 5 years. Then, in the next 5 years, 4 of those remaining 20 will still be functioning. In another 5 years, 3 of those 4 will disappear, leaving 1 out of the original 100. That's a 99% small business fatality rate over a 15-year period. Gauge your own situation and look ahead. Are you an employee of a small business? If so, the numbers are not on your side. Or do you own a small business? If so, there is hope because you have the power to direct it. Too often, what ends a business or a job, or what casts an onerous spell on a life, is death by a thousand cuts. This is relentless erosion caused by recurring inefficiencies and their offspring, fire killing and distraction. These time wasters undermine efforts to create and sell a good product that has a viable market. And in personal life, you've seen it in those who can't seem to break out of the bad luck syndrome. For business or personal life, it's not mysterious bad luck that takes people down, it's serial inefficiency. The great news is that inefficiency is easy to correct if one can see the cause of it. As the 10-year anniversary passed, my days spiraled downward into ever-deepening chaos. I leaped from one predicament to the next as crises multiplied. The days were crammed with cash flow crunches, chronic staff absenteeism, and innumerable customer complaints. The office temperature was too cool, or too warm. We would run out of critical office supplies and not have the time to leave the office to replace them. Turnover among TSRs was incessant, and scheduling was haphazard, put together at the last moment. In year 10, we went through more than 60 new people, and my total number of staff was 12. TSR trainees would start work, stay for a week, and quit. My employees were unhappy, and the same held true for our clients as they endured a still marginal quality of service. Making payroll was always a challenge. Every 2 weeks, it was a last-minute hold-your-breath epic as we gambled that all payroll checks would clear. Twice they didn't, and I went to employees' homes with cash to cover their bounced checks, pleading with them to give me another chance and come back to work. I was the heroic jack of all trades, the master fire killer who would work as long and as hard as necessary. The years drifted by. My teenagers would wait for me at home as I flailed around at the office late into the night. When I finally came home, I would check to see if they were sleeping okay and then stumble into my bedroom and climb into bed. I would lie there exhausted with that deep, deep fatigue way down deep inside the chest. Bills were not paid on time, both at Centrotel and at home. Collectors called day and night, checks bounced, and NSF fees accumulated, sometimes over $100 at a time. The people at the bank felt sorry for me as they marveled at both my endurance and my ineptitude in keeping the money straight. For a while, my two teenagers shared the office space with me because we could not afford a place to live. They went to school during the day and at night slept on bunk beds in the back room of Centrotel's small office. When I could, I slept alongside them on a cot. Then, after the kids had gone off to college, in one long stretch of 7 months, I answered calls as the sole TSR on the midnight to 8 a.m. shift every night. Here's the kicker. During those 7 months, Monday through Friday of every week, I also worked in the daytime from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m., taking care of 100% of the administrative and management tasks. This meant each weekday my shift began at midnight and ended no sooner than 5 p.m. the next day. Weekends were a relief because I only had to work the midnight to 8 a.m. shifts. My work week exceeded 100 hours. Of course, there was no social life. I didn't have time for friends. During those months, I was sleeping just a few hours each night and never in a single stretch because, as a sole midnight TSR, I had to wake up each time a call came into the service. Throughout the shift, the medical and veterinary emergency calls came in at a steady pace. Lying on the floor with a pillow and a blanket, there was the occasional straight hour of sleep. After my 7 month stretch of graveyard shifts, when I fell back to my normal 80-hour work weeks, it was impossible to sleep through the night even when there was the opportunity. My body had become hardwired to perform a day's work with 3 hours of sleep. I wondered how soon my physical and/or mental collapse would occur, but there was no relief due to my intimate involvement with every aspect of the operation. The business would immediately fail if I wasn't there moment to moment. For the body and the mind, few things are worse than long-term sleep deprivation, and eventually I succumbed to the stress. It was a depression and exhaustion that inhibited every thought and action. My performance became clumsy in the face of escalating problems. Things were getting worse by the day, and after 15 years of accumulated trauma, the end was near. If things were so bad, why didn't I throw in the towel and get a regular job? I was terrified of rejoining the workforce as someone's employee. The thought of having a traditional job sent shivers down my spine. After all those years of being on my own, working for someone else would be a nightmare for me and for my employer. I rationalized, if I am in hell, at least it's my hell. Playing a game I couldn't win. I had no idea what to do other than what I had always done, to dig in and take care of whatever came up. It was horrible, and the fire killing got worse. I kept at it. My existence was like the whack-a-mole game in which little grinning-faced moles keep popping their heads up in any one of a dozen holes. I would whack one mole and two more would emerge. My hammer would respond in a flurry and the mole heads would be rammed back down in their tunnels, one after the other. It was a beautiful performance, a remarkable demonstration of dexterity and power. The Whack-A-Mole Game, per Wikipedia. According to Wikipedia, once the game starts, the moles pop up from their holes at random. The object of the game is to force the individual moles back into their holes by hitting them directly on the head with a mallet, thereby adding to the player's score. If the player does not strike a mole within a certain time or with enough force, it will eventually sink back into its hole with no score. Although gameplay starts out slow enough for most people to hit all of the moles that rise, it gradually increases in speed, with each mole spending less time above the hole and with more moles outside of their holes at the same time. After a designated time limit, the game ends, regardless of the skill of the player. The final score is based upon the number of moles the player struck. But despite the heroics, the mole whacking was distracting me from seeing what was necessary to fix my business and my life. Centratel's daily disaster control was diverting me from facing the reality that I was playing a game that should not be played, a game I could never win. Illustration: Jim Morrison and Mick Jagger. Morrison and Jagger are arguably the best lead singers rock has ever produced. Morrison's voice and lyrics, Jagger's voice and flair. Jim Morrison's short wild ride was fueled by his brilliant observations and brazen thought images, built around a mystique of chaos. He wallowed in the haunting darkness and wondered about the great unknown beyond death. He lived in chaos, too, awash in alcohol and drugs, abusing his physical and mental systems. He died at the age of 27 after just 4 years of performing and recording. His too short life was the antithesis of systemization and order. Mick Jagger, however, has been hammering away for better than 45 years, 10 times longer than did Morrison. Essentially, Jagger is general manager and CEO of the Rolling Stones, personally attending to the operation of the band's enormously sophisticated and complex touring recording machine. He is as fit as any 25-year-old, eschewing drugs and alcohol. Whether it's creating music, performing, recording, or managing the enormous complexity that is his world, system improvement is clearly his primary aim. Enormously talented, healthy, and wealthy, a connoisseur of antiques and art, he is a master of systemizing, tweaking, and maintaining. Is there something you do to your body that is making it less efficient? Are you excelling in system management in some areas while sabotaging yourself in others?